Welcome to the Militant Grind Show, where we dive deep into the journeys of those who've mastered the art of being their best selves. Every episode is a testament to resilience, dedication, and the pursuit of excellence, embodying our tagline, the most honorables. Here you'll find inspiration, insights, and strategies to elevate your life in every aspect. For more empowering content and to join our community of achievers, visit us at militantgrind.com. Let's embark on this journey together because the grind never stops. Are you ready for a radical transformation? Join the ranks of the most honorables. Our proven methods forge resilience, sharpen strategic thinking, and unlock your true potential. We'll challenge you mentally, physically, and spiritually, preparing you to overcome any obstacle. Visit militantgrindacademy.com and begin your evolution. Greatness awaits. Forge your path. Ignite your future. Most of all, join the movement.
Today, we have Marcy Axelrod, a 25-year keynote speaker, award-winning author, and renowned strategy and innovation consultant. Her work with top high-tech firms has accelerated growth and individual achievement worldwide. Marcy's groundbreaking research into how people achieve and why they choose to show up and how they choose to show up is helping thousands reach their potential and enabling companies to innovate and thrive. Her acclaimed book, On Your Game, and the upcoming How We Choose to Show Up combine consulting strategies, neuroscience, psychology, and behavioral economics to guide people and businesses toward success. Marcy, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Sherman. It's so great to be on your show. Thank you so much. And I should mention the second book is out, How We Choose to Show Up. Mm-hmm. It became a bestseller within about a month, which was just kind of a fabulous, unexpected thing, because I certainly didn't play any of those games that are out there. buying reviews and et cetera, et cetera. So just,
yeah,
it was pretty cool. So
yeah, it's good to see that you actually did it the ethical way, because I wrote a book too, and I'm an author, and people were like, oh, you could just become a best-selling author. And I was like, why would I pay that much money just to say that I'm a best-selling author? Like, that makes absolutely no sense. Like, there's no real reward in that.
That's exactly right. So I'll tell you what the reward is for me, because some really interesting things have happened. There are two very distinct things that I'll mention. And I think, Sherman, it's going to resonate with you straight to your core. Gave a speech to a few hundred people at the Motor City Casino out in Detroit last year. Mm-hmm. And gave my speech, walked off stage, didn't think anything of it. Within about 10 minutes, which was a long time, a woman comes and finds me and she says, you have to go back out. We're holding up the whole event. She said, there's a line of people waiting at the stage and they won't go. So you need to come back. So I came back out thinking, I don't know what's going on. And there was a group of people. Mm-hmm. And right up front was a man with tears coming down. And I sit down on the edge of the stage and he rolls up his sleeve. And he said, and he revealed a tattoo of a man's face. And he said, this is my dead twin brother. He was killed at age 27. And he said, you, for the first time in my life, have given me the words to explain to people what he did for me. He truly showed up for me. And then he went on to explain how he showed up in based on the model that I have, which I believe is simply how nature designed humans to show up. And everyone's crying. And right there and right then, like, that's when you've made a difference. It's definitely not buying reviews to get a bestseller, whatever. It's simply that. And whether it's the book or a speech or just chatting with someone at the beach, mm-hmm. you know, that's the meaning that I think we all seek. And it's really never something you can buy.
Right. Right. Well, that's powerful. And I love how you circle the word choose on your cover. Wow. Because I'm not sure when I had the conversation, because I talked to so many people throughout the day, but also tell people that we actually have the power of choice. Mm. And often we feel like this is just me and this is just how I am, but we choose to be who we are. Right. And so What made it, like, how did you come up with, like, how you choose to show up? So say, like, from somebody from a certain demographic, they'll say, okay, this is all I know. This is how I was raised. I don't know any different. Set me for who I am. But I now feel like those people make a choice to be who they are, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Lots to say there. So I should say, I'll talk about the publishing thing, but then I'll also talk about choice. And sometimes we don't have it. And that's in the book too. Mm-hmm. So a couple of the publishing houses that came to me offering to publish this said, the title of a book needs to be what someone wants to achieve. So that when they see a book that says, like, truly show up, like, they're more likely to do that because there's like an I want to truly show up. Right. I want a book called like Money and Fame. I want that. Right. Mm-hmm. And I looked at them and I said, well, first, that's not me. I'm not into I want. In fact, like, that's like what the book is telling you. Like, let's get this right. Mm-hmm. But it's an analysis of how human beings are choosing to show up. And with that, how we're actually designed to do it and what the difference is. Right. So, like, I need to be true to myself, and I don't want to succumb to the marketplace where literally the majority of products and services that are out there are trying to solve for a problem that shouldn't exist, that we created.
Mm-hmm.
We create the fact that we've got this mental health crisis, and there's a direct line between minutes on social media and teens killing themselves.
Mm.
We created the need to have a car as good as your neighbor and a big house and all this stuff that doesn't buy happiness in any way, and in fact makes us miserable and poor and stressed. We created that marketplace. And when the publishers came to me in that way and said different things, I said, thank you so much for helping me to understand the type of guidance that you're going to give me.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate what you just taught me. And I'm choosing to work with a different group. Thank you. Right.
Hmm.
So in terms of the word choose, very successful people, including, I should say, a chief speech writer for an American president, one of our president's chief speech writers, agreed to edit my book. She was one of my editors. Yeah. And it's interesting because when I was originally thinking, who do I want on my team? I thought, I want someone who is needed to convince hundreds of millions of people to take action, to mm-hmm. do what they think is right. Mm-hmm. How do I find those people? Because that's who I want on my team. And one of the titles that came up happened to be chief presidential speech writer. And I thought, how do I get one of those on my team? And would you believe I got one of those on my team? I'm not going to tell you which president. It doesn't matter. It was a very popular one on both sides of the aisle.
Have been Barack Obama.
Anyway, let's just say believe apolitical. The point is, that person told me, oh my goodness, we choose how we show up. And she said it was one of the biggest epiphanies. And she said, I'll never show up the same way again. I wasn't choosing. I said, that's what the book's about.
Mm-hmm.
The book is about, and there's a continuum that I'll show because people tell me it's memorable. People say it's memorable. Tell me if you can see this and I'll send it your show notes.
1, 2, 3. I can see it.
Barely there. Just showing up, which 80% of the people do 80% of the time, and truly showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Just showing up is what my research across 20 years, it shows 80% of us do 80% of the time. So this is the, like, yep, I'm good to go. Check my look, the weather, head on out. I'm going to be emptying the dishwasher or driving while I'm listening to this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be doing this while I'm doing that. My good friend's ready. Let's go head out. Like, it's just, we move from one thing to the next, but our attention has a quality of being partially engaged, but partially disengaged. It also mm-hmm. has a quality of being narrowly focused, which happens to be affiliated with the left hemisphere of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to pause there and not get into that at the moment, but that is the most important thing, because this hemisphere of the brain, Sherman, It can't read the language of your body.
Hmm.
It doesn't know what you're feeling. It doesn't know if you care at all about me, about what I'm saying, about anything, because you're an object to me. When I see you and get shit done with, right?
Mm-hmm.
Checking it off, moving through, phoning it in, being stressed in any way puts us over here.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed it to survive, but it has much more to do with paying attention in a way that has power over, that just wants to manipulate things and get it done, and everything becomes a thing. It's an abstraction. It's a piece of data. It's just something to be acted on and dispensed with so that we can then get to the next.
Right.
And that's just showing up. And the feedback I've gotten is that a lot of people need to understand that, because the mindfulness movement and all these things that we do to de-stress and be more and feel worthy and get rid of our imposter syndrome and our fear and everything else, a lot of those things totally leave out this reality that we choose how we attend. We choose what system of attention we pay. And that's what creates what we see. Whether anyone's care shows up for us,
mm-hmm.
it's based on how we're choosing to attend to the world.
Right. Right.
That's everything right there. It's massive.
Yeah. And I like listening to you say that, right? I think about, I go to the gym almost like 6 days a week. And so I tell myself, like, when you're in here, you're this person. So you must act as such. Put your phone in your bag. Don't text. Don't do anything. You are this. But that's the way I'm choosing to show up in order to be effective. Because you might see somebody in there that's just like, okay, I'm doing whatever. And they don't look as confident. And that, like, that you can see that in their workout or their training. But me working out with like professional bodybuilders and athletes and things like that, it's like 99% mental, you know, what you can do and what you can't achieve. And so the other day I was in the gym and I'm a strong guy and I saw this young kid. He was looking at me and I could tell he was amazed, right? And so I was putting on more weight and I was just like, you know what? I'm just going to mess with him. And so I walked up to him. He was like kind of shocked. Like I walked direct because I have like my demeanor is different. So I can understand why he was shocked. But I, you know, told him to come here. He was kind of nervous. And I was like, hey, man, I want you to spot me. And he was like, no, man, I can't do it. I'm weak. I can only lift this much weight, man. You know what, man? I was like, hey, come on. I need you to spot me. I know I can lift the weight, but I just wanted to do an exercise with him to have him build like the confidence to like break the mold. But if he should have been like in the perfect world of bodybuilding and showing up, he should say, sure, man, I got you. Let's go.
You uplifted him, and you want to know what? Next time you see him, you can ask, hey, man, you ready to spot me again?
Right, right.
You know? And he'll be like, affirmation again, like maybe I'm worthy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, look at Sherman over here.
Right.
I feel such love that you did that. And I just want to thank you. I want to thank you for doing that. I have an image of this younger kid who hasn't made himself as strong as he wants to be, either emotionally or physically.
Yeah.
And you just totally propelled him. You gave him a really big step forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was that kid before too. And it just like, reminded me. He probably would ask me like, man, I'm like, man, I was working out probably when I was, you know, younger than you. It's not magic. You just have to be consistent and just keep going. And that's one thing that I want to tell people is like choosing to show up. That could be the whole thing for this podcast, is that you want to basically chip away every single day, do your best every single day, and things are bound to happen. But I also like, I'm to a point in my life where it's like, whatever I'm doing, I'm like, okay, look, when you go in here, you are this type of person. So act as such. Like me being a parent, I told somebody, I'm like, man, I have to be a totally different person as a parent than I am a friend, than I am a husband, than I am a all kind of different things. And I'm just like, but at the end of the day, I'm making that choice. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So do you feel like we always have to choose like in multiple occasions? Like, or am I doing something to drive myself crazy? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think what you're saying is there are different qualities and behaviors that are the parent you want to be, and the professional you want to be, and the athlete you want to be, right? And the friend you want to be. So I'm not so sure what you're choosing is to be someone different. What you're choosing, Sherman, is to make use of the knowledge, the wisdom that you have about how to be your best Sherman to your children, to your spouse, to your friends. That's very different than choices that people make when they're suffering. And I'll give you an example, a choice, quote, to be seen as, or a choice that they feel lesser than, or a choice that they feel better than, or a choice that they need to defend themselves. Like those choices are very much of an inward mindset. And what Showing Up talks about is take the mirror and go like that. Take yourself from a small S self to a big S self. Connect with others. Recognize that being a unique person isn't being separate from the rest of humanity. And when you turn your self mirror out and you focus on others, you are authentic. You are real. They feel your care. And all of a sudden, the concern and fear and unworthiness and imposter syndrome and all those things that we suffer with just dissipate, because now you've got this resonance going on, this attunement with the other. And you actually become one. There's actually a word for this that's in my book about interpersonal. It's not interpersonal neurobiology. It's intra neuro resonance. It's something like that. It's in the book, and it's basically what happens when two people look into each other's eyes. And I'm not talking about lovers with I'm talking about strangers who just look at each other, and what happens is our brainwaves start to resonate. And when that happens, the mind, I mean, according to these medical papers that I read, the mind actually is created in this third space. It's not just in you. It's not just in me. It's in this third space between us that we are merging. And the reason I bring this up is because when you connect with others, you're showing up as your best self. So whether you choose to be this way or that way, it kind of becomes like not really the main point. Right. You're really being who you need to be. So tell me about your kids. How do you show up to your kids? You have sons or daughters?
I would say it's a mix between me showing up loving as well as disciplinary at the same time.
Right.
So it's like, it's a weird way to balance, because me growing up myself, all I was shown was discipline and kind of like a ruling with the iron fist type of style. Like, coming from a military parent, a parent that was in the military, that's what it was. And I'm sure like a lot of people did have parents in the military experience the same type of lifestyle. But I more so put my own spin on it, where it's like I'm also going to express love and grace with my children at the same time. But they also know not to cross a line with me.
Right. You know? Love with boundaries.
Yeah. Sure.
Can I ask you something? And I don't know if you're going to want to cut this out of the podcast. You are looking at a screen and I'm not seeing you look directly at me.
Yeah,
and
if my camera's right. Yeah.
If it's okay, is there a way to move your camera? Because I want to look directly at you. I care about you.
That's fine.
As a human being, and I want to be.
I can't see you though. I'm just letting you know. But if you want to look at me, that's fine. I'll be trying to do it the best way I could. How does that look now?
Now it looks like you're looking at me. I'm so surprised. No one has told you. No one has asked you.
No, maybe they.
See your eyes. Do
they
will
have.
You,
No, they have. But it's like I have an external camera and I have a big screen in front of me.
Oh,
so
I
it's
see.
Like I could look directly in the camera, but then I will have to like look to my side a little bit to look at you. but that's fine.
You can do both. So this brings up actually something else that's in the book. And then what I'd like to do is I want to get at nature's model of how humans are designed to show up, because I think that it's kind of a life-changing thing. And I'll mention right here, by the way, people, this is my research, what people say. They say, at work, I truly show up. Mm-hmm. When it comes to my parenting, sometimes my teenager drives me nuts or my kids scream, or it's just tough because they're young and their emotions aren't regulated. So I kind of go down here and I just show up.
Yeah.
But when it comes then to being home with my spouse, it's like they get whatever's left. They mm-hmm. just they get my exhausted, my grumpiness, my whatever's left. And when I show this slide in my speeches, people are like, I mean, it's like people laugh and they're like, yep, you nailed it. That's exactly right. And I say, yeah, but let's actually push on this. Let's actually talk about this. Is this what you want? Where would you like your dot to be, right? Shouldn't your partner get the best you've got? Shouldn't your kids get the best you've got? How do we make that happen? When it comes to caring, and I'm just searching for the page here. I thought I had it. The continuum is... It's also the levels of care, because when you're barely there, you don't really notice others. It's fine if they're just objects.
Yeah.
You're either burned out, you're sick, you're ill, you're grieving, you're depressed. There's something going on and you are barely there.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't feel others. You don't even notice others. They don't show up in your right hemisphere at all in your space of care. As you move up toward just showing up to the right, and I'm not sure I can actually find this, but I'll send you the image so that you can put it. Oh, I found it. As you start to notice, you move from your left hemisphere into your right, and you start to tune in. You're drawn to that person. You start to tune in, and they notice that you tune in. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is you start to feel with, and that's the resonance and attunement that I was talking about. You feel with, and they feel you feeling them, and you know that this is going on. Have you had that experience of feeling felt ever, maybe by your wife or child?
Yeah, I actually feel that. Because I feel like my children and my wife, they know who I am. And so they could kind of like tell, like they'd be like, oh, okay, I know what he's up to right now, or I know how he feels. But I'm pretty much like I'm a very telling person. I don't think I'm the good at like showing a face that doesn't resonate with how I truly feel. But I feel like most people are that way. They just think that they can hide it. Like I could look someone in the eyes and I could be like, I know how they feel about me. It's kind of hard to fake that and not be authentic when you're with somebody and you're looking at their movements and how they interact and things like that.
It's so interesting that you say that. Well, first of all, I'm thrilled that you're authentic. And the fact that you feel that most people can tell. So as our world becomes less and less connected and unified, which it very much has in the past 300 years, and as we focus, as we multitask more, as we're more stressed, et cetera, we become more sociopathic as a society. And we've lost a lot of our authenticity. And that's why a lot of people are very much working on that, is because they can kind of show up and like just play something off, or maybe be sarcastic about it, maybe laugh about it, but not be true to themselves.
Right.
Because it feels unsafe. All of a sudden emotion comes up and it's not comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
It feels unsafe. So to protect ourselves, we emotionally detach.
Right.
Step back. And in doing that, now we can lie to mm-hmm. each other. And that's how we can look at each other as objects instead of as humans. And the sad thing about that is once we other each other, you're you, I'm me, I'm not like you, you're not like me. And then I can categorize you, and then I can dislike you, and then I can hold things against you. And God forbid I could hurt you. And when I say I mean, I literally, like personally, I'm on the opposite, if I see an ant in my kitchen, I let it crawl on a napkin and put it outside, and I don't even just put it right outside, I put it on a leaf. So anyway, but in society, that's what's going on. That's how people can hurt each other, and they can show up and be unkind. So what you're talking about, where you feel that people know when you're not really all true to yourself, a lot of other people think that they can get away with it. And it's just normalcy. They've normalized to the fact that they can kind of put one over on anyone, and that they kind of have to be seen as a certain way,
yeah,
or have to please people, and they aren't true to themselves. And then a lot of life just becomes like a show yeah, that you put on.
Yeah.
And the challenge with that is that when you're trying to really feel good about yourself and get into the green, and the only cure for that is actually care about people.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you care about them and you feel with them, there's an emotional safety where you can just say, like, that doesn't feel good to me, and I don't want to do that, or thank you, but it doesn't feel like that's who I want to be, and I'm going to say no to that vape, that drink, that whatever it is, that activity. Yeah, but it's really hard for people, because truly showing up requires that we're able to shift how we attend to the world, that we can switch from our left hemisphere into our right,
mm-hmm,
by choice.
Right.
And what it means is we have to step back. We have to recognize I'm in this narrow little thing,
mm-hmm,
that's kind of unimportant. It feels unimportant. It feels kind of dead. And we need to recognize this isn't a meaningful thing. So I need to step back and I need to reground. What's the big picture here? Oh, it is meaningful to empty the dishwasher, because I'm then creating a more loving environment for my kids when they get home, that we can sit with each other instead of getting other stuff done. Instead of busy time, it's going to be together time.
Right.
And this is meaningful to me.
Because you chose to make it meaningful. But then on top of that, one thing that I will interject and say is that we're living in a world full of distractions more than ever. Right. Like, you can be entertained all throughout the day through apps, through social media, through talking to someone on the phone, through texting. And what I've done, that you actually just mentioned, is that I cut a lot of stuff out, and I had to like refocus and regroup and say, okay, how have I always wanted to show up? And I feel like once you're in the realm of people pleasing and putting up a show, you start to lose touch of that. And I was like, well, what really interests me? Before you came, before we started the podcast, we were talking about stocks. And then I had to think back. I was like, man, I was a part of a stock pitch competition at 15 years old, and I won first place out of like out of a program with kids from colleges like USC, UCLA, all of these different programs. And I was at a Cal State College, and my team won first place, even over teachers. So I was just like, if you take that person from that moment and go all the way to like me being a middle-aged man, you would think that person was like a multimillionaire right now. So it's like you lost touch of what you were passionate about, because like this is talk about like the Bible, you became of the world. And like becoming of the world nowadays is putting up a show. It's not like being authentic. It's not like being you. It's like, oh, that doesn't matter. Let's do a show. And I have a daughter that's 11. And for some reason, she always said that she wanted to be a scientist, right? Like from four or five years old, I was like, oh, damn, I have no idea where you got this from, but okay. And then after a couple of years, she said, I want to be a YouTuber. And I was like, oh, God, no. Oh, God, no. But then she talked to her about it, and she went back to being a scientist. But it's just like, it's just crazy how the world is just like shifting. It's like putting up a show. Like you said, I love the fact that you said that, because we don't really want to be authentic to who we are. And me myself, I was really beating myself up, and it was like, I just hated the way how things ended up, hated the way I felt, because it was just like, in some circles, it's not cool to be you. It's not okay to be you. I'm sure there's a group of friends that you've grown up with, and you can't come up to them and talk about like, oh, did you see what happened in the stock market today? They're probably going, what the hell are you talking about? But that's something that generally interests you, that you like right. to talk about. So it's like, right. what do you do?
Well, I've got to say, I mean, so what you're talking about is extremely important, Sherman. I mean, we need to be with people who want us to be our true selves. Mm-hmm. I had very few friends growing up. There were two girls who I was friends with over time. I stuttered, which is probably why I'm a speaker today. In fact, I think it's a very clear cause of my being a speaker today. And I was always in roles where not only did I need to speak in a clear, definitive way, but I needed to, I was telling CEOs of some of the world's biggest high-tech firms what to do. Mm-hmm. My clients were Hewlett-Packard and Cisco and Motorola and Storage Tech, oh, wow. Symantec, SAP, on and on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
The point is we need to be with people who accept who we are. And if we're with a group of people where we feel we need to be seen as, we're going to go to bed every night feeling a sadness, feeling a detachment from the truth of the world, because the world needs us to be who we truly are.
Right.
So something inside of us is going to feel the stress, make us ill, and it's going to come up in some way, either in fits of anger, anxiety, depression, not performing that well, not being able to sleep. It's going to show up in some way, mm-hmm. and then it's going to seep into how we parent. And then our kids are going to grow up with the sense that there's just something wrong. Mm-hmm. Like none of this stuff doesn't change over time. We pass it on down, and we got it from our elders. My parents, who did a fabulous job, they absolutely did their best. I am so grateful for them. However, back then, the parents didn't sit down with their kids and really help them feel felt. It was just kids ought to be seen and not heard. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really get the connectedness, the feeling felt that I needed. And I'm learning now that I'm passing it down to my own kids. Mm-hmm. And I'm recognizing now, this isn't okay. Look at the issues that look at the friends who they're choosing to be with, right? Talk about friends, right? It's friends who fulfill what they learn to do, which is that if mom is like pulling on her to like, tell me more, because the more she shares with me, it's still insufficient because I didn't get what, because my parents didn't listen to me. She's then going to choose to be with kids who are emotionally shut down because she can't deal with her mom who's asking for more emotion. And I'm thinking, I don't want her with kids who are emotionally shut down. They're from homes where they somehow felt emotionally safe to be who they are in some way.
Right.
Right? Maybe they were very happy and energized and the parents couldn't take it. And they said, like, would you just calm it down? Would you calm mm-hmm. down? You're always jumping around. You're always so happy. You're calm, right? So that kid then learned to just shut down, that they're not okay the way that they are. And they have to live on eggshells because their authentic self has no place in the home.
Right.
Anyway, so I agree with you that most people really do feel that they have to like be seen as a certain thing. The best advice that I have is for people to sit with that and recognize this is not okay. They need to choose how they're showing up. Mm-hmm. That the implications of what they're doing are absolutely vast and are making the world more of an ill place. So what they need to do is say, I need to be true to myself and I'm going to go be with people who accept me. Showing up is an acceptance system mm-hmm. because we're on that continuum bouncing around right. all day long. If you don't sleep well, you wake up, you're in the red, your back hurts, your throat hurts, you're grumpy, you can't think well. And then at some point, maybe you have a good meal, you meet with a friend or something goes well. And then you move up in the green. Maybe the next day thing, you do sleep well, you eat well, you get a great workout, you help that boy in the gym, you feel great about yourself. But then at some point, you're tired and you move back down. So, I mean, bouncing around all day. Everybody gets to do that. And that's actually important. We get to do it, mm-hmm. and everybody gets to, and everything gets to as well. The weather, our vote, the company, the government, social justice norms, the votes of the Supreme Court, everything shows up.
Right.
And we have a choice of how we show up to it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. The power of choice. And that's pretty interesting how you said about your daughter, because I have four kids and they all have different personalities that I have to accept and manage. And sometimes I'm like, can you please stop talking to me? But then I'm like, you know what? I'm just letting them express themselves how they want to be, how they want to express themselves. But then it's like when I talk to their teachers, they all have a unique personality that they love. Like my daughter's super talkative, super creative, always wants attention. And you have to be the one to say, oh, that's a nice picture. Oh, that's cool. Stuff like that. So yeah, I love how you said that. It's like, because I always thought, I was like, you know what? There's what I want my kids to end up being. But then it's like, I would rather have them be whoever they want to be and be the best at it. So I have one daughter that's into basketball and the sports, and she doesn't like to wear dresses. Then I have one daughter that wants to wear a dress every single day if she could. And I'm just like, golly, like, how am I going to? But I'm like, you know what? I'm going to just let them two be themselves. I'm not going to tell this one, why don't you wear a dress like your sister? I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be like, hey, y'all were put in this world for whatever reason. I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, you have to be the best at it.
Right. Right. Well, and just be true to yourself.
Right. Because yeah.
Being the best, let's be careful with that. I know people who've ended up in treatment centers because their parents said, do your best. And somehow the way that the daughter internalized that message was that you're never good enough because you're never the best, like on a global stage. How often do you just sit with your child, one or many, and just feel with them? Quiet body, quiet mind. There's probably no words, because the moment you're here, you're not attuning. You've got to get out of your frontal cortex, that whole worded world, which is a superficial thing, and get into your feeling mode and just feel them, because those are the moments that are going to give them the safety to know that they are loved, that you are there for them, you are with them, they trust you. That's the parenting that all of us really need to be doing.
Yeah, I actually do that quite often, and they do it with me. And it is kind of surprising because I never had that. It's crazy, like on Father's Day on Sunday, I'm in the bed. I sleep with my underwear on only because I get hot. So I'm in the bed and all of my kids come in the bed. One is on this leg. One is on my chest. One is on the other leg. And I have four. I'm trying to make sure that I can manage four people all taking advantage of my body. You know what I mean? And I feel like that's an important bond to have. Just to be like, come here. I just want to hold you. I just want to express this type of love. And then I'll be like, okay, come on, we're going to work out in a garage. And I'm like, drill sergeant then. But I was like, if I could figure out a way, come on, let's go, push, push. But I feel like that creates a space where they could trust me, they understand me. And one powerful thing that I've discovered when it comes to parenting is that when you express that kind of love with your children, they end up doing better and end up doing good because they don't want to disappoint you, you know? So it's like, I didn't even really know that growing up, because it was more so like, I was fearful of the wrath of my father or of my mom or my parents. And that really, once you were like me, I was born a rebel. So I was kind of like, the fear really didn't matter after a while, you know? But now that I have a daughter, and their moms are like, I'm going to tell your dad. They're like, no. And it's not the fact that I like beat them and throw them in the closet. It's like, I don't want to disappoint my father. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy how that works, because I went to Chicago for one of my cousin's son had a college graduation party, right? And I watched him grow up. He would come out to California stay with me for a while, we'll talk. And it was just surreal seeing him graduate from college. And he did a speech, and he had like the whole family there supporting him, right? And he said that I've done my best or completed college, et cetera, because I didn't want to let any of y'all down. And I just felt that that was like so powerful for me. I'm not even sure if he remembered he said that, but I was just like, this is the difference between this side of the family and this side of the family. Because when you have that family support and people showing up for you and being there for you, like you just said, creating that bond, and you go off to college, you don't want to come back and have people look at you like, come on, man, why did you, you know, because you know you have someone that cares about you.
Right.
So that is way more powerful than anything that I've ever came across.
Yeah. Can we just take a moment on your show right now and honor you and what you, I mean, the fact that you have your kids crawling into bed with you, laying on you, and you know the significance of that, and you just let them feel you, and the fact that it's skin on skin is just unreal. Like, it doesn't get any better than that. You can only do it when they're young, because Lord knows your daughter's not going to be on you later, right? And you're not going to be naked, right? You're going to anyway. This is so beautiful. This is what creates a secure attachment, and maybe some of your other guests have spoken about attachment. Have they done that?
No.
Secure attachment is what enables each of us to feel grounded, to know who we are and why. And that is the skill of our self role. Okay. We show up in three roles, and it's important that we talk about this. Let me just put it on the side for a minute, just to just keep it with you. And if more parents, especially fathers, were like you, this would be a more peaceful world. So Sherman, please, from the bottom of my heart, accept my awe, my thank you, like for everybody, because your kids are out there and they're impacting others. And our impact, it actually goes three layers deep. This is the work of Nicholas Christakis. Have you heard this?
No.
So each of us has 20 people around us who are 45% more likely to do what we do just by being with us. But then that person's friend is 25% more likely to do what you do, because it goes through too, but it doesn't stop. It goes through your friend's friend's friend is 10% more likely to do what you do. So your daughter feels regulated, loved, peaceful. She feels grounded because she laid on daddy's chest on Sunday morning and it was just wonderful. And she's got her brothers there and her... So she's in school and she's calm. And then there's someone who's next to her, and that person feels her joy, her ability to focus, her ability to work hard on something.
Yeah.
Her love of science is now really coming out. Why? Because she's not stressed about something else. Mm-hmm. Because she isn't feeling in the back of her head, my daddy is disappointed in me. She's not feeling that. She's feeling the opposite of that. She's feeling, I have everything I need in this world. Everything I need in this world. Mm-hmm. This means she can truly show up with, you know, focused and achieve and really be there for others. I don't mean achieve in a like meaningless market-based way of having stuff and power and crap. I mean, really achieve the way that humans are designed to, which is to be peaceful, kind, loving, supportive. So that's what you've done. That is what you've done. And it's going to go on. And she's going to choose a partner in life who gives her what you gave her.
Right. Right. That's the most important. Trust me. Like, I have older sisters and we talk about our family history. And then I see the result of certain ways that we were raised. And I was like, oh, hell no, I got to shape up. Like, this can't happen to me. Not to say that, like, that's one of the reasons, but when you actually break it down to that type of level, and you're, as a parent, all of us want the best for our children at the end of the day. And one of the best things that I've came up with myself is that if you want to be the best, if you want your children to be the best, you have to emulate that as well in some form or fashion.
Right.
So I told my daughter, I was basically just using her as an example to screenshot and send to another family member. But I was like, how would you feel if daddy stopped working out? She'll be like, well, I'll feel this way because you always tell me to work out. So you should be doing the same thing, basically. Right. And I sent that to the other family member and I was like, see, these are what the kids pick up on. Like, if I call my daughter and she hears that I'm outside, her first assumption is, daddy, where you at? Are you in the gym?
Aww.
All the time. If I'm leaving the house, daddy must be going to the gym. Oh, daddy's in his office working. Oh, daddy's doing this. So I'm more so created an environment where it's like, okay, what am I known for when it comes to my children? Like, what kind of habits am I ingesting or doing that they see me doing?
Right. That's
like one of the most important things, because like we talked about earlier, we may think that people aren't noticing what's going on. Like, you go outside and smoke weed, a cigarette, or whatever, and come back in the house, don't act like your kid can't smell you.
Right. And don't act like they don't know.
Right.
Yeah, definitely do what you do. And the interesting thing about doing is that action isn't isolated.
Mm-hmm.
There's a thought behind it and there's an emotion. Think, feel, act. They go together.
Right.
So they know what you thought when before you did that action, you made a decision,
mm-hmm.
and they know how you feel, right?
Right?
So all of that is mimicked. If I could, let me bring in the second role in which you show up. So you showed up as a big S self, a self focused on others, right? A mm-hmm. big S self. It's the self of the indigenous peoples. It's the self of Eastern contemplatives. It's the self that's really at the foundation of every religion. That's the big S self that is connected to something larger beyond yourself. It's not the small S self of how do I look? I'm being judged. What am I going to wear? Do I have, right? Like all of that, that's the small S self of our modern world. And that right. That's the detached, unhealthy, miserable, striving for meaningless things. On their deathbed, like what this is not the life that I had chosen, right? Or why didn't I spend more time with these people? Okay, so there's a small S self and a big S self. You were a big S self, which is awesome, but you were also in your other two roles in which all human beings show up at all times, which is you were in a situation. You were a member of a situation. You were in bed, your kids were on you, you were welcoming, you were loving, you were truly mm-hmm. with them. And there was a reverberative process of you feeling them feeling you, a goodness, a silliness, a fun, maybe a stillness, but everyone was there and you were playing off each other. Mm-hmm. It was very much of a dynamic, alive flow. And that's what life is. It's a dynamic, alive flow. And then you were in a third role as well, which is you were a member of something beyond the self. You were a member of a family, you were a member of a community, you were a member of society, you were a member of a religious group. All of that is still with you,
mm-hmm.
in you. So at all times, we are all three things. We are a societal member, a situation member, mm-hmm. and a self. Now, society kind of forgets the other two. Society, like when I'm giving a speech and I ask people to draw a circle and I say, put lines that show what portion of the circle do you live in as a self? Is it all of it? Is it most of it? Is it part of it? What part of your day, let's say, do you spend feeling like you're truly within a situation where you are present, you are engaged, you are part of this flow?
Mm-hmm.
And what part of your day do you feel like you're really a member of something beyond the self? A societal member. What a lot of people do is they default to, I'm a self half, or mostly self half the time. And then like, they just split the rest, 25% societal member, 25% situation member.
Mm-hmm.
Other people say that's total crap. I'm just a self. All of me is a self. All of me is a self. I mean, yes, I bought a hybrid car so I don't burn gas, but my whole world is about me and I'm not happy. Very few people, and a lot of people strive to be present and that whole mindfulness focus, and they want to emphasize their situation role. But the point is, whatever our focus might be on any given day, the point is just know that we're in these three roles at all times.
Right.
And the more distorted we are towards self, the less happy and healthy we're going to be, and probably the less successful that we're going to be, at least by the measures that matter, which is having a positive contribution to the world. Because really, we're all just vessels, right? You're a vessel. You're a vessel of love for your kids. You're a vessel of information and wisdom for your listeners. Mm-hmm. You're a vessel of support for your spouse, right? We're all just vessels that kind of sense the world and respond. But modern society teaches us we're needy. We need stuff, right? We're small. We should be afraid that person's hierarchically above us or more important than us or better than us. And like, none of this makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
None of it makes any sense.
Right. Right. Wow. Wow. I'm trying to think of like my next thought, because that was pretty deep, because I've been having something going on in my mind that I tell myself often. It's like, you have to embrace all of you. All of those Shermans, all of those are you. Embrace it all. And I feel like we're living in a society where we have to be defined. And when someone tells me, like, tell me about yourself, I'm like, oh God, what part do you want to know? You know what I mean? Like, for somebody that's been has an extensive resume, that's done this, traveled here, that's not really complacent, that's a loaded question. And there's like, because I was reading up on you, I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Like, what hasn't this woman done? Like, Wall Street to Silicon Valley, you wrote a book, you did this, you did that. And to the average person, that seems like, oh my God, you've done so much stuff. You did so much. Oh God, it's too much. But at the end of the day, I look at it like, well, they got it done. You know what I mean? Or they're doing it. And you're just different than the average person. Like, and that's okay. Now, that's not average. Come on.
Well, it really is, because society defines us. It is average. I'm so average. Let me tell you why it might seem like I've like done all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a household where at the table at dinner, my parents, who were both physicians, they would mention to me something about their day. And my mother would say, I caught in a 7-year-old boy a symptom of something that, had it not been caught, it would have debilitated his life. And I noticed something, and I sent him out to be tested, and they found this, and now he can be cured. And my father would come home, and my father actually founded a field of medicine, nuclear medicine. And he would tell me, so he had his table, which is a scanner. It was like an early CT scanner or MRI machine. And he would say, Angel, when people are on my scanner, my table, they're afraid. No one wants to be on my table. And I actually had the king of so-and-so on my table last week. And then I had a janitor, but he said, Angel, today I had a 7-year-old girl on my table. And it's like, we all wanted to cry. You don't want to be there. It means there's something really wrong. And what he taught me is that it doesn't matter what the person is, what label they have, they're scared. They're people who are scared. And I learned we're all the same. We're all the same. And the other thing that I learned is you can do anything as long as you care about people.
Right.
You will have an impact on the world. Anyone from any background who grew up with the same messages that I got would be like me. And had I grown up down the street where I was told, why can't you get anything right?
Hmm.
And this grade isn't sufficient. And you like that sport, but I don't like that sport. You can't do that sport. You have to go and do this other thing.
Right.
If I was told that, I would be a mess. So society defines us. In fact, there's an amazing book called Selfless by Brian Lowry, who's a professor of organizational behavior at Stanford Business School.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually explains, we are completely defined by the messages that society gave us. I will send you a link and you can put it in the show notes. And he actually has a has an example that's really extreme that I think you and your listeners might really appreciate. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that there's a woman who became the head of the NAACP in the state of, I want to say Virginia. I might not have the state right, but it doesn't matter. And her skin is white. She's Caucasian. She's white. Yeah. How do you get to be the head of the NAACP if you're white? And the story that he tells is, so her husband's black, her kids are mixed. I believe she has one, no, she's fully white and she shows up as white. However, when you speak to her, the way she moves through the world, her mindset, her choices, the way she sees things is through a lens that they thought was black. Mm-hmm. So to them, she was black. And they elected her and she did a great job and everyone was happy. And then something happened. There was some event. And her response to the situation, they viewed, that's a white woman. And then she was white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think her name is Rachel Dolezal. Yeah.
Yeah. So you might know about this. So,
oh, yeah, I watched a whole documentary about her, to be honest.
Oh, okay. So the point is that society, the messages that we get, look at Barack Obama, since you mentioned him before. He was woken up at 5:30 in the morning by his mother every day to study. Do you know that? Who would he be if she didn't do that? Like, if society didn't give him the behaviors and the preferences that he has, would he have been president?
No.
What about Michelle? Everyone who you see, I believe we would all, we are the product of what we're taught. And the people who are drug addicts on the street would be the president if they had grown up in the home of the president.
Yeah.
And the president would be the drug addict on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And let's never forget that. I have more to learn from the people least like me than I do from the people like me. I went to an Ivy League school. Everyone around me went to an Ivy League school. Right. So I went to, like, right? Anyway, when I just get up and I get my work done and I study like 3 hours a day. Why? Because I love to study 3 hours a day. Here's the most recent book I'm reading. It's like 1,000 pages and that's volume one of two. I highly recommend this book. I'll put it in the show notes. Anyway, it was rewarded to seek knowledge in an endless way. And it's truly my elixir of happiness. It's my liqueur. It's my everything. But it's because of how I grew up. So yeah. Like all the achievements and success on the side, it's just, we're just human beings and you are spectacular and you gave your kids what my parents didn't give me.
Hmm. This is right. I love the fact that you brought this up because you know, I went to school in the inner city. My friends were from Watts and Compton, and due to the crack epidemic in the 1980s, a lot of my friends grew up in broken homes and parents on drugs. And not too long ago, a friend from middle school had requested me on Facebook and I haven't talked to him in over 20 years or whatever. And it was because he was in jail for manslaughter. He killed somebody. And so right when I got excited because it was my friend from middle school and we just talked for 2 hours. And he just broke down like how it was for him growing up, father on drugs, living from house to house to house and not feeling like he belonged and things like that. And so I was just like, wow. So when that event happened, he just had all of this built up anger inside and he just lashed out on somebody. And it's kind of like crazy because I'm sitting over here thinking like I went to school with people who like that. That was a dime a dozen. But now my kids are going to school who with kids whose parents are actors and own companies and works for Universal and stuff like that. Like it's such a crazy dynamic where now I'm gonna be like, wow, I'm not gonna be surprised that my daughter talks like what they would say a valley girl. Like she lives in the valley, this is what they do. And so and I was just like, it's almost bound to happen because of the environment that they're growing up with and like what they see every day. And I often tell people, I was like, man, if you would have placed me in like a, you know, a affluent area, I probably would have went to Harvard as well or Yale as well.
Exactly.
But then I would have been average amongst those people, because that's expected of me from growing up in those type of environments. And so now I see exactly what you mean, because I often tell some of my friends, I'm like, if you look at where we grew up at and where we are now, average person from this area is supposed to be like this, and you broke that barrier.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, say if you were from this area and you achieve what you achieve, that would be nothing. But just due to the fact that you came from this and now you're this, that's more substantial than right. somebody growing up in an affluent neighborhood and being right. successful, because you had to deal with more trials and basically right. try to recreate yourself from what you've seen and become what you right. never saw.
Exactly. And the people you grew up with have more grit, more motivation, more wherewithal than the people who had it easy mm-hmm. because of the struggle. I'm a little unique. So I couldn't speak from age six onward. And I mentioned this in both of my TED Talks. I started to stutter, and literally my throat would lock. Like nothing would come out other than grunts. It was awful. And then what goes with it is like the stress leads some eye to blink, and then you have twitches, and it led me to just, okay, I'm not going to contribute. I mean, I know that what I have to say is more important than what anyone else in the class has to say. This is when I was like six in second grade or something. This is what I'm thinking, but I'm just going to shut down. I'm because I can't get it right. And that struggle isolated me tremendously. So even though to a certain extent, I'm like, I am the product of my environment, I had a very different and very significant presence of what I was struggling with, which was all mine. No one else was struggling with it. And I think that really impacted me at least as much as everything else. Yeah. And you know, all of us have something. Mm-hmm. All of us have something. And many, often there's a lot of the somethings. What's really important is to be grounded in ourselves, which means just sit and think and figure out, what are the things that make me who I am? Why am I the way that I am? Because when you know that, you're gifting yourself choice. Mm-hmm. This is how to be grounded in yourself. Like there's a skill for each role, grounding in ourselves, right. readiness for our situations. And I talk about what readiness is. It's not what you think, because the moment is always different. So it's really understanding what the situation is, that like how our moments crowd the next and kind of impute truth on the next moment. Once you understand that, you're more ready to show up to what will be. Mm-hmm. And then the role for our society is connectedness with intent to serve. I call it alltelligence. Anyway, grounded, ready, connected with intent to serve. Those are the skills that enable us to truly show up. There's probably a lot. I'm sorry to get into this, and maybe it seems like it's too intellectual, but when you get into each one, you see how real they are. Mm-hmm. It would be a different podcast to get into each one. So people can read the book.
I mean, you gotta keep something. Like, yeah. Yeah. Well, so when did you start talking? You said onward, but I just didn't know when you actually like started talking.
You mean being able to?
Yeah, being able to. Yeah.
So my goal, as I graduated my senior year of high school, my goal, and I'm going to try not to cry here, my goal was to show up on a college campus, being able to have a conversation, like not being known to be a stutterer. Mm-hmm. And that's more or less when I started to be fluent enough to not be known as someone who has this massive speech impediment. So,
wow, you got over it after 18? Like, wow.
Well,
what were you doing? Because the reason why I asked this is because I have a friend that still stutters till this day. He stuttered. I've been knowing him since I was 11, 12 years old. So it's just kind of interesting for me to hear that it happened after high school. Well, it was still going on after high school and you got over it. Because usually it's like a stint when you're a kid and then boom, okay, now you're good. But that long and get over it, I've never heard that.
So I still stutter. I'm surprised you haven't noticed it. I feel my throat start to lock and I choose a different word. Sherman, there were a number of times I wanted to say your name and I couldn't. There were some pauses where I had to let my throat relax. So I am definitely still a stutterer. And what I will tell you is the whole trajectory of choosing to be not just a writer, like an author, but a speaker. One of the reasons that's so meaningful to me to get on a stage and being able to orate and like share meaning with people through the word, the spoken word, and the energy that you can kind of corral on a stage, it's because of the struggle, right? Mm. Our struggles define our path. Right? So yeah. Your struggles define your path. The whole reason you're such an amazing, connected father is because you got orders. You got cold-hearted dictates. Get this done. Mm. Demanding this of you. And that's why you're able to be the quality of human being you are. Like gifting the whole world with how you're, not just you show up, how your children show up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow, that's very interesting. That is like so, I want to commend you for being like so courageous to even like get up on the stage and speak. And then especially doing TEDx's, like, oh my God, like people are so afraid of public communication that don't have that problem. Like I remember having some people on the show. Also do shows in person, and like before it starts, I can see them shaking. And I'm looking like, but you are this type of person and you speak to people all the time, but they were just so nervous. And just to hear that you challenge yourself to say, you know what, I'm going to be a public speaker. And you even have the book me on your website, like book me to speak for you, like at your, and spoke in front of like all of these massive corporations. And golly, like that takes a hell of some mental fortitude to do that. That's like, because I often think, like, I'm a big fan of David Goggins, right? And so he always says, you want to challenge your mind to do the things you don't want to do. And I've been hearing this because I listen to him talk all the time, or like little, you know, TikTok clicks, YouTube clicks and stuff, clips and things like that. And this is probably like the most impactful thing that I've heard when it comes to getting over something that you probably are afraid to do and don't want to do. Because who would have a stuttering problem and want to do a TEDx talk? Like I don't get it. It's like, when you think about that, it's like, why would you even want to but you challenge yourself? That's probably the ultimate challenge. Because trust me, I remember like speaking in front of this program that I'm at and things like that. And I just know that it takes such mental strength just to go up there and talk in front of like 10 people. Now, some people can't even do that in front of their family. Like, hey, go up there and tell the family this or talk to the family about that. And they can't do it. But golly, right. I feel like that should be, I wish you should put that. That should be like your headliner on your website. You know what I'm saying? Like, oh my God. Yeah, like hey, I'm very, very much amazed. It's like me having a problem with public speaking as well, because growing up I had a slow speech and it was so bad where it's like people thought that I was mentally retarded or something. Like one of my friends called me and told me that, like, I mean, I thought you were like this. But it was because my mother is from the Midwest, and so they have a slow way of talking, and so I adopted that. And I'm in California, where people talk a little faster, so they thought something was wrong with me. But I have to really project my voice, kind of like how you have to relax your throat. Like, say for me, I have to exert myself extra when I talk, just so I could be on beat. But naturally, if I go to Chicago and I'm me, I don't have to do that. They'll think, oh yeah, how long you been home? Like in Chicago, I'm from Chicago. But when I do talk, I do have to put like extra effort into projection and stuff like that. So I'm familiar with it. But then on top of that, it's just like going from that kid that used to be teased for talking slow or someone thought this or thought that to having a podcast and being a guest on a podcast. It's just like, dang, like I really challenged myself and now I'm here. But doing the TEDx, that's on a different level. So, but well, one day.
If you want to do a TEDx, come to me. I put in 18 applications. I got 2 yeses and I did 2 TEDx talks 2 weeks apart. Uh-huh. So, oh, cool.
Yeah, I definitely do. I'll definitely reach out to you for that. But I don't want to spend like all that time talking about that, but I basically am trying to express to you why I feel like that's so commendable. Like me having like one of my childhood best friends, like we stayed together in college and all that. Like he still stutters till this day. So I know the struggles with that. He will tell me I can't get certain jobs. I can't do certain things because of my speech impediment. And I was just like, wow, like he can't do a sales job or anything like that. There's only so many things he could do because of that problem.
Right. And I definitely thought that would be me. I said to myself, I'm so limited. What I do is going to have to be like no one's going to have to need to talk to me. It's going to have to be behind email or writing, or I'm going to have to be invisible somewhere. And this is very much attached to showing up. I mean, so this is my calling, and I'll explain why. Because of the stuttering, and I'm 6 years old, okay? And I'm looking around, and I can't get a word out. That's when it started at 6, because we had moved from Baltimore to Boston, because my dad was in the Air Force during Vietnam. So we moved from Travis Air Force Base to Boston. And I lose my ability to speak, and I'm watching all these other kids. And they can speak, but they're being kids and they're being mean and they're being rude. And there's the bully and the scaredy cat and all this. And I was looking at them and I was just irate. You can show up as you choose. Like you can choose. And yet you were just mean to her and you did. And I can't show up as I choose. And that was in my head from a very young age, and just every day, I was like, why aren't you choosing to be nicer? Why aren't you choosing? Because I was so in my head, because I wasn't really participating. I was like removed. So then at age 12, my mother would drive me 2 hours each way. This is between, I think, third and fourth grade, to a rehabilitation hospital to learn this way to speak that really, I mean, I sounded like I had Down syndrome completely. I sounded like it was just an awful technique to use, because I went from one issue to another in terms of how I was perceived, just as you mentioned. And at the rehabilitation hospital, the average age was 70 or 80. And these people, they've had strokes. They're learning to sit and to stand and to hold a fork and to walk. And there I am, and I'm 12, and I'm thinking, don't you, like, mom, aren't you going to try to help me with the stigma, like the confusion, the fear? I belong here. It's like I've had a stroke. Like this is trauma. Mm-hmm. But of course, I didn't have the benefit of being able to process what I was dealing with. And what I noticed is that all these people, they actually know how they want to show up, just like me. They know how they want to show up and they can't. And that's when I said to myself, where's the playbook? Where's the blueprint? Where's the model? Where's the framework? Why is this so damn hard? So I started to search, how are we designed to show up? Nature must have this answer. Nature designed us. Call it God, call it whatever you want. There's a design of how we are supposed to show up. And it took me about 20 years of social science research. And around the world, I was doing studies with tens of thousands of responses, hundreds of thousands of data points. And the model just surfaced. And I'm going to show you what the model is of how we're designed to show up here. I think I showed it before. But basically, we're in three roles. We're a self. We're a member of a situation, and we're a member of something larger, a family, society. Okay, that's over here. There's a skill for each. Grounding, be grounded in yourself, be ready for your situation, which means understanding what a situation really is, which is not what people think, and be connected with intent to serve in our societal role. And of course, there's a level. There's levels inherent in everything, right? The sun rises and it sets. There's levels of things. 1, 2, 3.
Right.
You're either barely there, you're just showing up, which is that middle ground that's like a loss to everybody, where you're not really there, like you're partially there, you're not really there. But what does that mean? Or you truly show up. That's the model. And it's common sense. I'm not creating something that doesn't exist.
Right.
I'm putting on paper what has, there's a universal show up network out there, and we're all part of it. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's always been there. And it's not a peripheral feature of our operating system, right? It's our defining characteristic. So let's understand what it means to truly show up, and let's do it. And then the world would be a better place, and we'd all be happier and healthier, and maybe the planet would be a bit more sustaining. Anyway, so it's the reason I'm up on this stage as a stutterer is because I feel like I'm the vessel for this. I was designed to give this message to the world. So I better be able to speak, damn it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't mean to imply that the stutterers out there don't feel that way, that they better be able to speak. I just got lucky, and I thank God every day. When a clear word comes out of my mouth, I thank God. Whomever and whatever God is. I don't mean to alienate anybody. It's inclusive of everybody's God, or no God. So anyway, that's the story. And the thing is, we all have something like that. And I hope that everybody can sit down in a quiet space and start to do more of what they believe they're designed to do.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah, I also talk to my friend quite often. I say that there's archetypes among us. We just have to be true to whatever archetype we are and accept people for who they are. And me having a podcast and talking to people from all walks of life all around the world, I figured that out. I'm just like, wow, like we really aren't that different. We're just limited in what we've been exposed to. Seriously, because I remember on my way to Paris, I sat next to a Caucasian woman, blue eyes, blonde hair, with no doubt. And I had my preconceived notions, but we sat there next to each other and we talked. And it was just crazy how we just got a connection. Because I'm sitting over here like, well, what in the world am I going to have in common with her? You know what I mean? But then after we talked for a while, she told me some personal things that was going on with her life and with her daughter and things like that. I'm like, wow, we all have something that we have to deal with. You know, like I was a part of a gang, but I went to a school that was heavy in gang activity, right? And now I'm in the Valley in Los Angeles, and I'm talking to kids from the Valley, and they're saying like, man, like we had our problems with kids overdosing in school and drugs and all of these different things. And I'm like, what? I could never imagine it. But then it's just like, everyone has their thing. Like my cousin went to school outside the city, and he was just like, man, I have friends that did this and on drugs and all of these different things. And it's just like, wow, man, like there's really never a perfect scenario or a perfect world.
No,
like it might look like that, but when you really get on the inside, you start to see like, oh my God, like, huh? Because me being from the city and me going around like wealthy kids, and I'm like, yeah, the only thing I've ever did was smoke weed. They'd be like, what? You haven't did this. I'm like, man, we don't have all of those resources to all of that. I have no idea where I would even get this from, but it was just so crazy to them that this was the only thing that I've ever done.
Right. Sherman, please. You wield a lot of power with this podcast, and your listeners really need to understand. And I hope our conversation has helped. We are the same. Deep inside, we are the same. Some may be born with a family that stays together. Some may be born with a family that splits. Some may be born with emotional abuse that looks like one thing, or emotional abuse that looks like another. Maybe it's neglect. I mean, yeah, there's something. And I'll tell you, I have a daughter who's at a level 4 treatment center who I had to send away. And you'd say, my God, with a mother like me, how could she have these issues, right? And well, level four treatment, like
yeah,
let's just not get into what that means because I'm going to cry on your podcast. So it just means that she had issues where therapy at home and all the help from the school and all the love that a family could give was insufficient to help her. So looking at me, you wouldn't know that the kids, even in my home, you need some very, very significant additional help. And the thing is, we're all like, we all kind of suffer with the same things. And what we need to do is look past obvious, ridiculous things that can separate us. Like why can't we be race blind? Please. Why can't we be religion blind? Why can't we be politically blind? We're human beings.
Right.
We all want our kids to be happy and healthy. Let's just start there.
Right.
And if someone wants guns at home and someone doesn't want guns at home, why can't we just figure this out? And I think that the way to do it is to be human to human. Take our sense of self, our mirror, turn it outward. If we show up genuinely interested in how are you feeling right now, right now, and how can I help you in some way? When we show up like that, all of a sudden we're going to be able to have a different discussion about who we should be voting for or what the policy ought to be or what the school really ought to be doing on bathrooms or like who knows what, right?
Right.
This is my hope. So I really hope that showing up, so showing up talks about a universal design for what a human being is supposed to be doing and thinking and right, which is that we're always in our societal role. We are never separate from being, being an individual does not mean you're separate from. Right. What's happened is that we're so hurt. We are traumatized from the past, from the wars, from what goes on in our homes. And then to be able to function, we've detached from ourselves. And when we detach from ourselves, that's when we're detached from whatever we feel, care from that. So I no longer can care as much about the person who's in the meeting who kind of bugs me and isn't on my team. Right. And then I'm less kind to them. And then I care less about them. And then we've got your group and my group and we're doing this. And it's, if we can recognize that caring for each other is the foundation, and then we can start to heal ourselves. And once again, this actually gets back to choosing which attention we pay. The right hemisphere's attention is simply you're just stepping back and seeing the big picture. So this isn't just a podcast anymore. You and I now have a friendship. And it transcends the right now. Because you and I are going to continue to help each other for the rest of our lives because I care about you. Right? So I've just stepped back and I've shifted it from performance mode, which I was never really in, but let's just say, right? Performance mode in this podcast to caring about you and seeing across the long term. The doors that I want to open for you, the people I want to introduce you to, the photos I want to see of your kids, and I'm going to share mine too, right? So that is an example of switching from the left brain to the right. It's expanding what is going on right now. What is the situation? It's not looking at a screen, standing in a room at 5 o'clock on a Thursday. It no longer is that. It is no longer the thing that I do before dinner. It is now an ongoing thing that I want to put my energy and investment in to create a goodness that's bigger than me. That's my societal role. So I've just taken right now and I've made it I've explained my situational role and my societal role right now. And as more people think that way, that's truly showing up, is more people can be in all three roles, the less likely we are to look at each other for the color of our skin or how wealthy we might seem or whatever jargon we use and therefore economic strata we live on.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. I lived enough life that I'm like, I don't really don't care about any of that because I know intelligent people from all walks of life, background, et cetera. And I tell people like I define intelligence based off of how someone can process new information or information period. Like if I give you information, how do you take it and spit it out? And then I also tell them like our education system now is nothing but how well you can memorize something. So it's like me looking at your grades doesn't really like let me know that you're an intelligent or a smart person. It's really how you decipher information. But that's just how I look at it personally. Yeah, because it's like we say, oh, well, we went to this school or oh, we did this or oh, we did that. But then it's just like that's an achievement, but that doesn't define other things.
No, it doesn't explain how I look at the world, and it
Yeah,
doesn't
exactly.
mean that, that I was kind of, can I just say, Sherman, I'm feeling love. I'm feeling love for you as a human. I'm feeling love for the family that you've built. I'm feeling love for the work that you do. And I really feel the privilege of your welcoming me into this space with you.
Thank you. Thank you. I was really looking forward to this too. Like, I was like, okay, yeah, this is going to be interesting because it's crazy. Like, your motto being choosing to show up. And I've been talking about that for weeks with people. It's like, we have the power of choice. You could choose. You're not a victim. You choose to do this. You choose not to go to the gym. You choose to eat this food. Like, you could actually like make the choices to do better or create the habits to do better for yourself. So I was very excited. Very excited. Yeah, thank you so much. And is there anything you would like to leave people with?
Thank you for that opportunity. So, something that I'm told is really helpful for people, that I talk about at the end of both of my TED Talks. When you want to switch from doing mode, which is just showing up, which is the one that divides us, it feels meaningless, into the mode of showing up where you feel a sense of meaning and withness. A quick, easy way to do that is to take two fingers, like a big Sharpie marker, and take out your palm. Do it with me if you would. Sure. And draw a number three for level three, truly showing up. You can draw anything. You can draw a heart. You can draw anything. The point, feel your palm. Feel your palm. Have you ever felt that?
It kind of tickles too. It's crazy.
So what just happened is that you went from thinking to feeling. Okay, you went from using this part of your brain to using your body to sense. And we're only doing one of three things at any moment. We're either distracted or we're wandering, our mind is wandering, we're focused on something, or we're sensing. And when we sense, we free our minds and we can move, we can see the bigger picture of what's going on. So whenever someone is upset or just wants to shift into more of a being mode, trace your three.
Oh, you know what? This has me thinking of people that use the beads when they meditate or when they pray. It's like they're touching the beads, so it's like they're working on those senses and probably not focusing on like much outside. I wonder if that's a tactic that they use. Now I'm thinking about it because I saw a Muslim guy doing it. I've seen Catholics do it. They just take the beads or like the necklace or whatever that thing is, and they'll just pray while they're like going through it. And I was like, that's interesting. But I wonder if that like sharpens their focus now that
You know,
you said it
it's
that way.
really interesting. I'm so glad you connected that because it's a tactile thing. Tactile thing, and it brings you into your body. It quiets your mind, and then you have choice. Showing up, ultimately, what we're trying to do is switch into our right hemisphere more. Notice when we're stuck in the left. Ideally, you go back and forth. You just don't want to be stuck in that left power over get it done mode because then you treat others as objects and you're separate from. And that's when you feel unworthy and afraid and insufficient and all those bad things. You want to be able to switch. And that's a quick way to just step out.
Right. I'm probably going to do that when I meditate tomorrow morning. Yeah. Well, Marcy, thank you so much for being a part of this podcast. Like, this has been a very insightful conversation. I'm sure it could probably last for 4 hours. Well, I'm sure you got things to do and I have to go to the gym. But yeah, thank you so much for being a part of this. And your website, also wants to mention it is
choosetoshowup.com. And the book's on Amazon. And I'll tell people it's still 99. The ebook is still 99 cents. It's still at the launch price. Because I'm not really here to sell books. I'm here to help the world choose how we show up. So right. Please get the ebook. It's just go on to Amazon, choose to show how we choose to show up. This is it. And I'll send you some of the charts for your show notes if people want to see the charts that we reference.
Okay. Oh, for sure. For sure. Okay. Well, again, thank you so much. Yeah, all of your books are on Amazon, so that's good. I see that. All right, cool. So thank you so much for being a part of this. And yeah, let's get together again.
We hope you're leaving this episode feeling empowered. Remember, greatness is a choice. To stay updated on our latest content and continue sharpening your edge, hit that subscribe button. Let's keep grinding together. Remember to visit militantgrind.com.